from WLVR HD2 Bethlehem and Lehigh University, welcome to Prof Talks, where you can hear from members of the Lehigh University faculty as interviewed by student DJs and journalists. Prof Talks offers a personal view of Lehigh faculty while offering the professor and student an engaging look inside the mind, the person, the journey, the career, and the contribution our Lehigh faculty give to our students every semester at Lehigh University. Welcome to Prof Talks with Lehigh student DJ and journalist Lainey Delaney.
Hi, this is Lainey Delaney from the Brown and White and from WLVR, and you're listening to Prof Talks. Today I have Professor Amanda Brown, a history professor, talking about her class, History of Rock and Roll. Hello, Amanda.
Hi, Lainey. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. Before we get into the class, you know, I thought it'd be good to just do a little bit of background about you. So I noticed looking through, stalking you a little bit, that you were a soccer player for a long time. So I was wondering what it was like transitioning from being like an athlete for so long to then, you know, transitioning back from that into just day-to-day life and keeping that athleticism in your schedule, you know?
Sure. So I played soccer at Penn State for some years, and the process of retiring and picking up something new was not all that dramatic, because I actually came here to Lehigh to coach the soccer team here. I was a graduate assistant while I did my master's and while I did my PhD. So that definitely kept me involved in the game. I think I kept up the rigor and the demands aspect of it by entering a PhD program.
Right.
But I mean, athletically, I'm still really involved. I'm an ocean rescue lifeguard in the summer. I volunteer on the ski patrol up in Vermont. So I stay active, but just not as crazy competitive as those days.
Mm-hmm. You compared the rigor of athleticism to that of a PhD program. Can you elaborate on that a little more?
Sure. Well, you know, getting a PhD obviously requires a lot of commitment. I did my PhD here at Lehigh and also my master's, so definitely familiar with campus life, but a lot of commitment. You know, a lot of what I was pretty surprised by too is some physical commitment, right? A lot of late nights, a lot of reading, a lot of wear and tear on the body, which to me was surprising in a way. But I think you have to perform at a high level and keep pushing yourself and improving. There's a lot of constructive criticism involved.
Yeah.
but I do think that my, you know, long career as an athlete certainly prepared me for the rigors of it.
Mm-hmm. So you got your master's here, you got your PhD here. So you were a student at Lehigh for a very long time.
For a long time. I was thinking about it, and I think it was something close to a decade, right? If you consider the writing a dissertation, which largely happened off campus, but I've been involved with and in, you know, constant communication with this community for a pretty long time.
Mm-hmm. So obviously with a graduate degree, you're a little more removed from the campus itself than you would be as an undergraduate. But even still, in that decade, did you watch the campus change, evolve?
Yeah, you know what? I think my head was in a book for most of it.
Right.
But, you know, certainly as a coach, I saw a lot of, you know, new students come in. And there are differences in students from then than to now, but really not that much. Hard workers, curious people, you know, this is obviously a very smart community. So I think that that really translates across the board. So, you know, nothing too crazy has changed, you know, in my mind.
Were those kinds of things that you named about students that you saw over the years something that you considered in choosing Lehigh?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of fell into Lehigh a bit, not haphazardly, but maybe haphazardly. I was, you know, actually interviewing for jobs out of college, looking at public relations and advertising jobs in the city. I didn't really feel right about it. I wanted to do something more, and an opportunity came up that a former soccer coach actually turned me on to, that there was a graduate assistant position opening at Lehigh to coach. In order to get that position, I, of course, had to get accepted. So, you know, in researching Lehigh and researching the faculty and, you know, the quality of education and, you know, again, the academic rigors, I really thought that it could be something for me. And of course, a big challenge. So I applied, I got in, and, you know, then started this, again, decade-long experience.
Mm-hmm. So I feel like given your background with, like, you know, your business aspects, your, like, history aspects, American studies, all that, you kind of embody, like, this, like, very typical, like, Lehigh, like, interdisciplinary student, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit of an octopus in that regard. And, again, my work is very American studies, interdisciplinary, which is really fun because you can pull a lot of different methods from different disciplines and you can draw a lot of different stuff into your work. And I definitely bring that to teaching as well. So, yeah, I mean, I'm very much a product of Lehigh.
Right. After you had the initial GA ship and you were getting your master's here, what was it about Lehigh that brought you back for the PhD?
To be honest, the faculty. I had an amazing mentor, John Pettigrew. I worked with him. I thought he was just, really, fascinating, the stuff that he taught. But we had a really great working relationship. I looked at some other schools, and I ended up coming back here, and it ended up being a perfect fit for me. So definitely grateful that it played out that way.
Mm-hmm. What was the transition then like going from being like a student at Lehigh then to joining professorial staff, academic staff?
I mean, it seems almost seamless, and I have these weird moments when I'm teaching. I'm literally in classrooms that I was in as a graduate student, but again, like I said, not that much has changed. I was trained really well. I was a teaching assistant in the department. Again, I had the opportunity to work and learn under a lot of great faculty here. Of course, I taught other places before getting asked to come back here. It was a tremendous honor. I'm very excited to be here. But, it is a little different being on, I guess the other side of the podium or the table. But I think it's very helpful because I can very much relate to the students and I understand campus life and can really relate to what they're going through as well.
Where else had you taught before?
So I started teaching at Ocean County College in New Jersey at the Jersey Shore. I did that while I was working on my dissertation to kind of get my foot in the door. And then I taught at Monmouth University for a few years, again, at the Jersey Shore. I taught what they call perspectives classes, which are just interdisciplinary classes on a given topic. I taught American counterculture. I taught a philosophy class. I taught a course on gender and culture. And in the midst of that, I got, again, invited to come back here and obviously jumped at the chance.
Mm-hmm. What, like, I feel like there has to be, like, some sort of, like, inspiration, like, when you're, like, kind of designing, like, these new classes, that especially when it's something like that where it's interdisciplinary and you have to build all the blocks yourself. So where do you draw inspiration for classes like that?
So I think about topics that are meaningful to me. I mean, it's designing a class. It's a really creative process. It's not all that unlike writing and that you are going to spend a lot of time doing it. So you need to pick a topic that you care about. I think a lot about the audience, right? In this case, being students who will sign up for my class. I try to imagine what would be meaningful to them and attractive to them. And then I really evaluate what historical value it has, what other things we can teach. For example, we're going to talk about the history of rock and roll. There are just so many different elements of American culture that, come into rock and roll. So I think about, how I can connect it to things. And then, of course, what topics we're going to cover and maybe some fun, creative ways that the students can interact with the material. So it's a long process, but again, very, very creative in that way.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like your athletic background, like, ever comes out at all in, like, teaching?
Yeah, kind of. And I think sometimes it comes out in my reassurance of students that their best effort is often enough. And my civil rights course that I teach this semester too, we were talking about, writing papers or preparing essays. And my advice was, sometimes you have to let it go. And I think that comes from me being such a perfectionist and pushing myself so hard. But, with that being said, I am, very interested in getting the most out of my students. So I think the coaching element comes in a little bit. I try to push. I try to keep the standards maybe a little, higher, maybe like a level higher than what they would be, and try to get them to rise to the occasion. So I think that's very athletically minded, right. in that way. But yeah, you know, sometimes, again, being close to the experience of being in school and having a lot of other things going on, I am pretty mindful that they are, you know, while they're pushing themselves, like taking care of themselves and you know, getting the work off and really pulling the trigger, because it generally usually is really good at that point.
Do you notice differences, and I'm sure they exist, as both a professor and as having been a student athlete, just differences between student athletes and students who aren't on athletic teams?
You know, I think every student's different, so it's really hard to pigeonhole one or the other. Yeah. I mean, my experience as an athlete, I performed better when I was very, very busy. I think when I stopped playing, then I had to manage this excess time, so that was challenging. But, you know, across the board, I wouldn't say that I noticed distinct differences.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right. Well, before we dive into the history of rock and roll, I'm going to take us on a quick break. We'll be back in a second to hear more from Professor Amanda Brown.
You're listening to Prof Talks.
So when you get to the corner of Smith and Orchard, you're going to want to take a
left. You are not going to.
Then what you're
going to
do is turn onto Marcy Avenue.
Just broke up
and go past
and
the first three lights,
happy
and then take
it.
The next left.
I don't really
drive
think
five
she's
more
happy,
blocks,
but
and you should be
who
there.
Who am I to judge, right?
Park
anyway,
on the right. That's
I'll
what
see you
I heard
later
last
tonight.
It's hard to concentrate on two things at once, like texting and driving. Stop the text. Stop the wrecks. How will you stop texting and driving? Tell us at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Prof Talks on WLVR HD2 Bethlehem, a Lehigh University student production.
This is Lainey Delaney with WLVR and the Brown and White. We are back with Professor Amanda Brown talking about the history of rock and roll. So we talked a little about the inspiration behind the classes you shaped. So what was specifically the inspiration behind this class, History of Rock and Roll?
Sure. So one of my colleagues in the history department approached me, I guess, last spring about creating an online class, which was where this live rock class was born out of. And I was racking my brain and, you know, I kind of brought up a dream class that I always wanted to take and would want to teach. I mean, again, I'm a cultural and intellectual historian. Rock is clearly a big, important part of American culture. So I proposed the history of rock and roll, and also a very big rock fan. I thought, again, it would attract students. And from there, I developed an online class that was upper level, and then this semester made it live. So, yeah, that's the story.
So as like a cultural intellectual historian, like what does that mean, like specifically?
Sure. Basically, intellectual historian, it sounds very fancy.
Hoity-toity.
Yeah, right. I study the history of ideas. Uh-huh. You know, from anything from religious thought to political thought. I specifically work in social movements. So to make it short and sweet, I study the history of ideas and how they move and shape culture and cultural change, I guess.
Because you brought up social movements, I have to ask, have you ever done like an RTTP?
No.
It's this thing I did for a class once, and I'm going to like geek out a little bit about this. But basically the whole thing is like you get assigned a character, and you have to like act out as them for like a number of sessions in class.
Oh.
So like when I did it for a class I took on social movements, we transported to the year 1913, and we were debating like the feminist movement and then like the labor movement, and it was all like very exciting.
Who where were you, like in Greenwich Village or?
Yes.
Nice. So yeah. Who were you?
I was Mabel Dodge.
Awesome. So you had your salon and
yes.
Had everyone
oh my God,
over.
I loved it.
Yeah.
It was fantastic because like everybody had like specific roles they had to play within the character, of course. Like little some people were like wild card characters.
Yeah.
Which I was, which is very exciting. That means I had like extra jobs, I guess. And so part of it was I had to come in class in costume every day because of course I'm Mabel Dodge.
Right. Know? Right. Right.
And then part of it too was I had to host like a Wednesday evening event where I hosted a little salon.
Okay, well that seems appropriate for a journalist.
Yeah,
to do. That's actually one of my favorite periods in history. So good for you. That's awesome. I'll have to think about incorporating that.
What do you like about that period of history?
You know, it was just something that I had never really known that, well, I shouldn't say I hadn't really known, but it wasn't until like college or graduate school that I learned about the really robust counterculture in Greenwich Village. So there's a lot of writing from that period that I like. I've taught some of it, again, in my American counterculture class. And yeah, I just think it's really interesting, which it sounds like you do
yeah.
too.
kind of trying to loop that back into the history of a rock and roll course. So you've talked about this American countercultures class. How does that kind of like tie in with the history of rock and roll class?
Well, I mean, you can't really study, say, counterculture in the 1960s without studying
yeah.
rock. Mm-hmm. They are completely intertwined. So, and in this class, we're in the 1960s right now. We'll stay there for a little while. We're definitely going to look at counterculture as it is connected to a long historical tradition. And then we're going to look at where it's represented in rock mm-hmm. as well.
What year, what decade does the class start in? Where does it go from there?
We're in the 20th century. So the course is, it's an intro level course. So it's essentially a survey of the 20th century, of the American 20th century through the lens of rock and roll. While it could be argued that rock was, you know, born, and I mean successfully argued that rock was born in the 1950s, so we start with the roots of rock. So we look at, you know, major changes, developments in American culture that lead up to the beginning of rock and roll. And then we're going to go as long as we can. I mean, I would like to get up to, say, you know, rap
yeah.
and you know, extensions of rock and the likes, but we'll see if we can make it.
How does rock segue into rap?
Well, I mean, so I'm still kind of working on that part of the lecture,
yeah.
but I think if you think about cultural criticism, I think if you think about the nature of art to continue to evolve into something new, in rock, there is a lot of borrowing, and
yeah.
I think that, you know, at its core, some you know, essential elements of rock do show up in rap. Again, and thinking about how popular music, you know, reflects and of course moves culture, that's definitely a pretty important thing to talk about, especially in our contemporary moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I took a sociology of hip hop class here.
Oh, great.
One summer. And that was something that we talked about a lot, too, not only just, like, the borrowing with, like, sampling and mm-hmm. everything, but also just with, like the kind of, like, similar, like, cultural places that both rock and rap
yes.
kind of came out of.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to study because I'm a fan of both rock and rap music, so that was really exciting for me
yeah,
to study.
And so distinctly American.
Yeah.
There's a lot to learn about our culture from these art forms that, you know, couldn't have really arisen anywhere but here in the modern world. So there's definitely a lot to learn through that. That's great that you took that class.
Yeah, it was really awesome.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Could you give examples of, you know, like American cultural moments that exist because of rock? Or
sure. So, well, I'll give you an example. Like right now we are in the 1960s, early 1960s, and the unit that we're doing now looks at the revival of, say, folk. We just finished talking about the corporatization of rock after the decline of the first wave, right? Quote unquote first wave. With, if you think about Little Richard, Elvis, Buddy Holly, Johnny Cash, the rockabilly style. After that, in the 1960s, there was a big corporatization of rock where you have the production of like these dreamy teen idols, American Bandstand,
right.
And you know, in the midst of that, shared self-aware national youth culture is developed, and when that culture comes of age and looks at the world that they're inheriting and has major questions and concerns, right? Young people in college, say, looking at civil rights movement, having issues with free speech, you know, the escalating Vietnam War. Their criticisms are represented by a lot of the music that they are turned on to, right? So right now we're looking at folk. We're looking at how folk music addresses a lot of these issues and criticisms very bluntly, and then starting to talk about how the music kind of, you know, spreads conscious awareness and,
right.
and you know, facilitates change and you know, something of a more abstract way. So, I mean, in terms of a moment that happened because of rock, I'll have to think about it for a second.
Yeah.
But again, the class kind of ebbs and flows between historical context, right, establishing what's going on in the moment, and then delving back into the music, which is this incredible primary source that we can unpack and read and interpret. And then we kind of zoom out to the big picture and look at the influence of that music as well.
So how do you go about studying the music itself, the source matter there? Is it more reading, listening?
It's everything. And I'm actually glad that you brought that up, because so while the class is a history of rock and roll, it's also a, you know, strict meditation on cultural history. And we do a lot of time talking about, you know, the stuff of the historical field, research, writing, making arguments and the likes. And with rock, the source is so unique that there are a bunch of different ways to learn about it. So in my class, we read, you know, a textbook. We read articles from, you know, sources like the Rolling Stone or the New Yorker. We watch documentary film. Recently, we looked at some clips from Ken Burns' Country Music. We listen to podcasts. And ultimately, we talk about maybe the best way to write about, discuss a source like rock, especially in our digital age. So we learn the music in a lot of different ways. Right now, we're doing close readings where the students have a bunch of lyrics of folk songs. And then, you know, again, contextualizing each song with whatever historical thing it's speaking to. After we do that, we play the song, we read the lyrics, and then we treat it just like a piece of poetry or any kind of, you know, cultural text. So rock music has a lot of different elements that you could talk about, right? The lyrics themselves, the instruments, the feel of the music, the tone, and the like. So it really is just a great text through through which to view history.
With so many sources and different ways to like unpack, you know, like you were saying, you have podcasts, readings, articles, all that. How do you go about compiling all of that?
It's really hard. And so it's such a big topic. And I, you know, when I first, you know, got the go ahead to teach this class, it's like, yes, this is going to be the best class ever. I'm so excited. And then when you get into that process of building it, right, you kind of have to cast your net wide, you know, get your hands on everything. That is the moment where you have the panic attack. Like, how am I going to fit all this in?
Oh, good God.
There's so much great stuff. And then, you know, you read podcasts, or I'm sorry, read podcasts, listen to some podcasts that are so specific about a certain genre. I'm like, I don't, you know, this is not completely what I'm an expert in. So I have to make really strategic decisions about what to keep, what to maybe recommend on the side for people to listen to. And it is kind of a painful process sometimes. I have things that I really love and I really want to talk about, and they have to kind of, you know, end up on the editing room floor.
Right. Yeah, you only have so much time.
Yeah, so, you know, exactly how I make the decisions, I equate it to writing. It's like I have the crux of the course, which would be like a thesis statement, and then every time I incorporate something, I have to ask myself, well, does this speak to the, you know, bigger goal of the class, I guess. So yeah, it's a bit of an arduous process, but very much rewarding. And I get to read and listen to and watch a lot of really great material.
Mm-hmm. You you compare like developing a course with like writing something a lot. Are you like a writer? Is that like one of your big things?
Yeah, I am. And I actually haven't written about the history of rock and roll yet. We have to have lofty goals. I am writing right now, working with a publisher for my book, which is about the long civil rights movement and some ideas behind it, nonviolence and like liberal religion. So there is absolutely no rock in it, but it's still intellectual history in that regard. But yeah, I'm a writer, definitely.
Tell me more about that, about what you're exploring in your book.
Sure. So it is an interdisciplinary look at the long civil rights movement and liberal religion through this really unique institution called the Church for the Fellowship of All Peoples. It was founded in 1944 in the midst of World War II in San Francisco by this African-American intellectual and theologian, Howard Thurman. He was a mentor to Martin Luther King. He was the first African-American to meet with Gandhi. And the church is the first interracial, intercultural, and interfaith church in the United States. When I first came across it, I was like, this is really cool. What do I do with it? The thing that's so provocative about it, and again, we could talk about why this is why rock is such an important topic, was that it's reflective of the time and all the big ideas of the time in which it was founded, but it's still in existence and it's still relevant. Yeah. So without going on too much of a tangent, it's a book about that and other things.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about like the timelessness there that you're talking about with rock?
Sure. So, you know, as we talked about before, rock, I think, again, is distinctly American. The story of rock is the story of the United States, at least in the 20th century. But I think the thing that is so timeless about it, or at least that's important for us, is that it's so indicative and representative of the perspective of youth, mm-hmm. right? Of again, a rising generation with all of its idealisms, about to inherit a world that is, in you know, the eyes of someone who's not in the middle of it, flawed. And rock is, you know, rebellious in that nature. It challenges the status quo. It offers room for criticism. It offers room for artistic experimentation. That being said, it can be completely corporatized and you know, it is certainly a product to be sold. Mm-hmm. But the fact that we are still listening to rock and talking about it and caring about it, I think is really relevant. For me, I had this conversation with a couple of friends. So my parents are baby boomers, and I wondered out loud to some friends if maybe my generation was the first generation to love their parents' music, right? Like some music I love is 50-something years old. And I think that that really speaks to the timelessness about it, right? The themes of rock music from, you know, again, the very early years of rock up through, you know, now are still very much with us, whether it be through, you know, covers or the similar themes that keep coming up. And my students have talked about that a lot. We listen to old music and they say, well, this could have been written now because of this reason and this reason. And part of our challenge or part of our mission right now is to get to why. So we're working on that right now.
Why do you think it is that your generation is the first to love their parents' music?
So I think it speaks to, again, that youthful criticism. I don't know. Did you, in your Greenwich Village class, read any Randolph Bourne by any chance? Okay, I won't go on too much of a tangent. I kind of referenced him before when I was talking about it. But again, you know, say in the 50s and 60s, you have a really powerful and, again, united youth culture, right? Rock. Largely comes about because there are middle-class teenagers with time on their hand and money to spend. And I think that that music was able to... I just lost my train of thought because I was thinking about something else. But I think that, you know, the perspectives and the criticisms that came out of that music are still very relevant. And I think it's still very important to young people and to everyone. And when I say youth, I think I mean it more as an attitude than than a certain age. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we can talk about a number of different factors of why it's still relevant. But to me, that comes to my mind. Mm-hmm. It's fresh. It's, you know, it makes room for criticism. Mm-hmm.
Is it ever like kind of funny teaching like college students about how important like youth movements are and like youth is to greater culture?
Yeah, they like it. In the fact that I think every generation has its tension with the older generation, right? I mean, we can talk about millennials and Gen Z and, you know, how my generation and your generation is ruining the world. But we can talk about the benefits of that. And, you know, go back to rock, talking about timeless themes, a few of the students brought up The Who's My Generation. I think that that song could be very relevant right now. Mm-hmm. You know, people try to put us down. I hope I die right. before I get old. I don't think that, you know, the Who meant actual death, but before kind of becoming part of the bigger machine, I guess. So I think those themes are still with us. And again, speak to the college age demographic.
Are there any themes that you see your students identifying with, like, specifically?
Well, we got into civil rights and we got into free speech. We're getting into anti-war stuff. And I don't know if it's those exact themes, right? Like the Vietnam War is not going on right now.
Yeah.
But some of the principles and the foundations behind those themes are attractive to them. And they would equate those movements to, say, you know, environmentalism today, you know, the civil rights movement. You know, some of the work is clearly not done yet. And its issues are still very much with us. So in that way, they connect to it.
Mm-hmm. Is that something that is, like, important to the scope of the course, that kind of intersectionality around issues?
Probably, because to me it is, and, and it keeps coming up. And I urge them to try to relate history and the things that they're studying to their lives. Mm-hmm. So I think
best
that,
way to learn.
Yeah, right. And why study it if it doesn't matter to you in your life?
That's everyone always says about algebra. Like, when am I going to use this in the real world?
Yeah, right. Algebra. I'm like, well, I haven't used calculus yet, but people have, and they're important, and they're engineers, and we need them.
They take us to the moon.
Yeah, I mean, I think history gets something of a bad reputation because, listen, there are so many great history teachers out there, but I think sometimes college students come to, you know, this stage and they don't want to memorize dates and they don't want to talk about battles. Mm-hmm. But there is just so much amazing stuff to talk about that is still very important. And part of my job is to make it engaging and to sell it a little bit. so rock is a nice gateway into history. But again, the themes are relevant and are important. Mm-hmm.
How do you find yourself selling it? More with just, like, the conceptual kind of framework, or with, like, the source material itself?
I think both, and maybe I'm pumping myself up a little bit. But again, going back to just thinking about what I would want to learn and what I would want to talk about. And there are so many people that could teach the history of rock and roll in so many different ways. Again, I'm coming to it from my training and my perspective. So I think that, again, the selling point is just to get something that people are interested in. There's plenty of rock fans, and there are plenty of people who want to learn about it. And I think, as it seems that you do, can see the value in studying it.
Mm-hmm. Does the decision to teach a course on rock and roll come from, like, your own personal interest in the genre?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, as I mentioned, I grew up listening to my mom's music. Mm-hmm. We would drive around listening to Neil Young and Joni Mitchell and all that. So those influences were really important in my formative years. I remember I got concert tickets to go see the Beach Boys when I was five. They were very old because I had been looking at all the pictures on the back of my mom's albums.
Surprising.
Yeah, right? I'm like, wait, this isn't what I thought it was going to be. But I grew up in an area and still actually live in an area that is very, you know, music centric. I live right near Asbury Park, New Jersey, which has a great history of music, and there's plenty of concert venues. So it's always been a really important part of my life. And again, I think my historian brain has always been drawn to understanding the past through music as well.
Mm-hmm. Is that something, are you, like, a musician to yourself?
Nope.
No?
Mm-hmm. Nope. No
purely
musical talent.
There.
Yeah, I think I have good taste. And I like
important.
Concerts. Yeah, and I'm friends with musicians. But I have to be a bit nerdy about it. I'm coming at it strictly from, you know, a fan perspective and a scholarly perspective.
Mm-hmm. Water.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, I'm back.
Tell me more about looking at music from that, like, kind of, like, nerdy angle.
Okay, I mean, it's just really standard historical practice, right? So, you know, you have secondary sources, which are books and the likes, right? People commenting on historical topic, and then you have the primary sources, and of course, in our case, rock music. So Wait, what was the question again?
honestly, I don't even remember.
Okay. Talking about rock sources, again, like I said, there's a lot to learn from them. You know, the lyrics can tell you a lot about the time. So, I mean, I think if, you know, we were to, you know, create some sort of time capsule and put things in it that could tell somebody from the future about our civilization, well, certainly rock music should be in there because, again, it really is a good gateway into understanding our history.
Mm-hmm. You incorporate a lot of music journalism, it sounds like, in like the materials that you use for your course. Is that something that you examined like in your free time?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's important to incorporate popular sources as well. Mm-hmm. The Rolling Stone is a great resource. So again, there's really good cultural criticism in there and some styles of writing or some commentary that you might not necessarily be able to get from like a textbook.
Mm-hmm. Is it hard incorporating that cultural element like as well as the musical element and making sure you just have like the whole picture of everything you're studying?
Yeah, I mean, I would like to be like, no, it's not hard at all. but it is hard. And again, I think it goes back to that process of making sure that everything lines up to the broader goals.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I'm going to give us another quick break before we close it out a little bit here. Once again, I'm Lainey Delaney. This is WLBR. I'm with the Brown and White. I got Amanda Brown with me right here. We'll be back in just a second.
You're listening to Prof Talks.
So when you get to the corner of Smith and Orchard, you're going to want to take a
you
left.
You are not going to.
Then what you're
going to
do is turn onto Martin
C.
Avenue.
Just broke up
and go past
and
the first three
she's
lights,
happy about
and then
it.
Take the next left.
I don't really
then drive
think
five
she's
more
happy,
blocks,
but
and you should be
who
there.
Who am I to judge, right?
Park
anyway,
on the right.
That's
I'll
what
see
I
you
heard
later
last
tonight.
Night.
It's hard to concentrate on two things at once, like texting and driving. Stop the text. Stop the wrecks. How will you stop texting and driving? Tell us at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Prof Talks on WLVR HD2 Bethlehem, a Lehigh University student production.
Hello again. This is Lainey Delaney with WLVR and the Brown and White. I'm sitting here talking to Professor Amanda Brown. So now that we've really dived into the history of rock and roll, I want to ask about the other classes you're teaching.
Okay. So this semester I'm teaching the Civil Rights Movement, which is a 100-level course. It's smaller. There's about 16 students in it. And there are certainly themes that cross over, right? Mm-hmm. Especially when we get into the 50s and 60s, which we're just about to get into. Mm-hmm. Last spring, again, as I mentioned, I taught my American Counterculture course, which, again, connects to, yeah. can connect to this. Everything weaves together.
Mm-hmm. You find yourself ever like kind of like borrowing knowledge or like source material from those other classes where it all kind of ties in?
Yeah, absolutely. And when weeks happen where we're going to talk about some of the stuff on the same day, it's great because it's all fresh in my mind. But yeah, we were just talking. It's been a long day.
Yeah,
and I think too it helps. Like I said, my writing isn't specifically in rock, but I think my strength is that I bring all these other elements mm-hmm. into it as well.
That interdisciplinary focus.
Yeah, that interdisciplinary focus. You need to have it. But and also I rely too on my students as well to bring things up. So while I'm bouncing back and forth through ideas and bringing in some information from other classes, I'll put it back on them and ask if it connects to other things that they're studying or reading about or talking mm-hmm. about too. So it is a collective effort at that point.
Do you ever find yourself maybe not like changing the course of your course entirely, but like shifting a little bit when you get like new information?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's certainly wiggle room. And every class is a living thing in that we could get on a topic that is really exciting for people and there could be a lot of different things to say about it and we might shift in another direction. And looking ahead, sometimes I could see down the pike what's coming up and maybe change a reading or two, depending on, without really straying too far from the goals of the course, but depending on where we're going. So there's certainly a little flexibility in that mm-hmm. regard.
Just forgot it.
That's okay. I've been forgetting things too. We're on the same page.
Long day. let me check to see if I have anything to ask. Do you think people usually have expectations coming into your class, and do you feel like those are met, or like that they're just like slightly different than like what's actually executed in the class?
Yeah, they probably do, and that's what's a challenge for this class because there are so many music fans. Mm-hmm. So I had to make a lot of decisions about exactly what we're going to cover, and you know, a few students will be like, "Oh, are we going to cover this one facet of punk?" I'm like, You know what? That's really interesting, and there's a lot to say about it. We're going to cover this, and I make room for that in some of the assignments. So this is something that I should mention too. So we're talking about, you know, studying and writing about this really unique source of rock. One assignment that the students have is a one song essay. So they pick one song that is representative of a historical theme, a movement, an event, what have you. And they do like a close reading of that. They incorporate historical context, they incorporate some research, and they argue why that song, right? Why that cultural source, what that cultural source tells us about a certain moment. And then the next phase of that, right, thinking ahead about presenting rock in the best way, the next phase of that is for them to convert that into a podcast, mm-hmm. right, to elevate their writing a little bit, to really consider their audience. We have Jared Brown from the Digital Media Studios coming in. Mm-hmm. He's going to talk about certain software and some techniques in doing that. Mm-hmm. So that assignment, again, gives a little room for people to touch on what movie might not have covered and what's near and dear to them, right? Yeah. It's important to write about the things that you care about, right? As long as you can meet the standards and do what the assignment asks. So there's room for that. And then, you know, in the spirit of rock and creativity and thinking about audience, we move into, say, the podcast where you can really show off the argument. And that pushes students, too, to think about kind of being entertaining, right? When you're writing, you have to engage your audience, and also incorporating the standards of scholarly work into, say, the podcast. How do you show where your sources are from, and how do you keep it at a high level, but just writing it a little bit differently? So that's certainly a component of the cultural history aspect mm-hmm. of it. And like I said, allows room for the things that we missed.
Yeah. How do you think it changes the class, like in comparison to a class like calculus, where it's all brand new information, mm-hmm. going to a class where, you know, people probably have a little bit under their belt already?
Yeah, for me, that makes it really exciting because I can throw a question out there and get a lot of response. You know, we opened the class with introductions, and students talked about either their favorite musician or a concert that they've been to recently. It really helped us in terms of talking about and considering why music is important, right? How it makes you feel, what the potential of it is. So the fact that they come loaded with their own stuff and their own expertise is great. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, our class is very discussion-based. I want people to have opinions. I want them to challenge certain things and bring a lot in, because a plurality of perspectives just only makes things better. So from my point of view, that's awesome when they come in with their own stuff. And again, it challenges me too. Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't consider that. Let me think about it, and then we'll start with a discussion on that next class. So again, it's you know, there's a bit of a democratic vibe to it in that way.
How many people are in the class?
It is packed. There's 36. Mm-hmm. I think I had to turn something of 40 students away.
Wow.
It was a bit overwhelming and exciting.
Sold it well.
But there wasn't enough room in the classroom for everyone. So it is a packed class, which sometimes makes it a little challenging for discussion, right? Mm-hmm. I think in a big class, it's easier.
That was gonna be my next question.
It's easier to hide. That becomes a little tricky for me too, to pull things out. But, you know, when the students walk in the classroom, there's music playing on the speakers that, you know, sets us up for what we're going to talk about. So I think that kind of eases people into being relaxed enough to talk. So, again, a lot of good conversations.
Definitely. So you'd say that relaxation, like coming into class with a relaxed mindset with the music, helps facilitate discussion?
I think so. I think so. I don't know what they think, but it could be a nice break to the day. So today they walked in and we had a lot of American folk playing. So while I'm writing terms on the board and our agenda and, you know, passing a sign-in sheet around, that kind of sets the tone for what we're going to be talking about. And again, it's like, okay, we're at the history of rock and roll. There's this music playing. Mm-hmm. Let's get down to business.
Yeah, I definitely, when I took my sociology of hip hop class, he like started every class as well.
With, yeah.
Playing stuff over the speakers. And it was definitely like, even like casting aside, like thinking about relaxation and getting ready for discussion, like just putting yourself in the mindset of what you're about to learn is really nice.
Yeah. So see, so you're a good source for me. Was that helpful for you?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, see?
I really enjoyed it. And something too is, just like the interactive nature of the assignments as well. Like hearing about that podcast assignment is really interesting. It's just, you know, not like a very typical way of, you know, exploring an idea like that.
Yeah. And I mean, again, it still adheres to the historical standards. And, you know, this is a really good thing to, you know, talk about with like grad students who are going to be writing professionally and the likes. But I think it's fun. I think that, you know, if we talk about transferable skills, making a presentation and using different channels is really important. But again, it really pushes people to write at a higher mm-hmm. level, right? If you are a really wordy writer, well, a podcast is going to make you have short, concise language. So I think it's a really productive exercise in that way, both from a historical perspective and just a writing perspective mm-hmm. in general.
How did you decide to incorporate that into the class?
When I was here, I did work with digital humanities, a documentary film, and I've always been really interested in the ways in which, you know, historical writing is delivered, right? If you think, you know, the function of a historian is to contribute to civic life by getting that information out there, if things are just completely esoteric and only speak to a certain audience, well, it doesn't really do us much good. Again, that's my opinion. So I think that I'm not saying there's no place for books. There's a place for books.
Books are important.
No, they're very important. They're very important.
Fired on the spot.
Yeah, I just think that you could have a supplemental resource with that too. And, you know, think about how excited people are about the history of rock. There's so many documentaries and you know, there's so many mediums and things out there that we can consume about rock. So it's clear that there can be another way to write about it as well. So, you know, I just kind of nudge them a little bit to consider that.
Yeah, I think especially too, considering like, you know, surely you have to talk about the ways that technology has changed rock and roll.
Yeah.
You know, with the introduction of like, you know, like synthesizers, what have you. You know, so, you know, introducing a technological element to the class definitely makes sense.
Exactly. And you can't talk about the history of rock and roll without technology. Mm-hmm. And our experience in world wars and, you know, the development of radio, television, all that rock is certainly dependent upon mm-hmm. technology. So why not use evolving technology to really, again, highlight the source? Mm-hmm.
This is probably like a little bit outside the scope of the class because you said you're not really sure how far you're getting into mm-hmm. the future.
Yeah, I mean, it's planned. There's a syllabus.
But I mean in the sense that I was wondering if you have any thoughts about like how internet might have changed rock and roll, because I know that's maybe a little bit farther out from where your class might stop.
Yeah, it's far. Well, one thing that we've been talking about a bit is the function of disruptive brands. Uh-huh. So rock really, you know, came to be because of these independent labels that challenged the status quo, the way that things have always been done in, you know, the kind of mainstream, you know, creation of music like Tin Pan Alley and the likes. So that led to some discussions of things like Napster and music sharing. And it seems like these disruptive brands, you know, changed the nature of the industry clearly. So while there is always going to be pushback from the status quo, one of the conversations that we've been having is, well, does, you know, the rest of it need to adapt to the times? Is the industry going to change? And then how are we going to catch up? So mm-hmm. again, rock touches on everything. There's a lot about, you know, business and involved in it too.
Especially with the corporatization.
Yes.
Well, it's been good to have you here.
It was great to talk to you.
Yeah, I'm so glad you came in. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Me too.
I'm glad. This is Lani Delaney with the Brown and White and with WLBR. I'm here with Amanda Brown, and we are signing off. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Prof Talks on WLVR-FM HD2 Bethlehem. You can find this interview and more at our website, go.wlvr.org/podcasts. And thank you for listening to Prof Talks, a Lehigh University student radio and journalism production, exclusively at WLVR 91.3 FM HD2 Bethlehem.